You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 24th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, David Dayen on the continuing fraud in the mortgage industry, on the rightward shift of the courts, which is keeping people from making claims against the banks. And maybe we'll get to a little conversation about how the Republicans have already won this budget fight. And even worse, folks, it's quite possible we may see, yes, I know, elements of that grand bargain come back after all. Also on the program today, President Obama at the UN General Assembly. Apparently we're not interested in regime change in Iran. John McCain crying in the corner, hopes dashed. Bibi Netanyahu's got quite a speech to deliver in the coming days. He's going to have to change his red line, apparently. Also on the program today, politics, the main hurdle to after-sex birth control. Right wing wants to keep us still in the dark ages. Also, the U.S. signs a gun trafficking, arms sales treaty, conventional weapons treaty. And, of course, it's just in, President Obama, responsible for the attacks in Kenya, says Alex Jones. Republican GOP rebranding effort appears to be dead, folks. And Ted Cruz, increasingly a lonely guy in the Senate. All that and more on today's program. Just a reminder, the app continues to wow people. I don't know why you wouldn't have the app if you have a smartphone. If you don't have a smartphone, then I can understand it. Also works on your iPad and on some Android. What do you call those? What are they called?
Tablets. I was just, what are you talking about?
Yeah, you can get it. We set up a new URL to just if go directly to get the app. For those of you who can't handle the backslash, majorityapp.com, majorityapp2ps.com. Go there, get it. Don't forget, you can support this show by buying your junk at our Amazon, through our Amazon link. You can either go to the homepage of majority.fm, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your crap there. We get a little cut. You can also get there via the app. Just forward yourself the link onto your computer. Bookmark it, buy your stuff there. You will notice no difference. We get a little kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Folks, if you haven't become a member today, with all the access you get on the app, with all the extra material you get, and forget that, just to support the show so that we can deal with our tech issues, so that we can get a bigger staff to make up for some people's coming in late sometimes. And well, people don't know that I'm looking at you, Mike. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dan. We recorded this last night. Enjoy. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure always to welcome back to this program David Dayan. He is a contributor to Salon, The New Republic, Alternet, American Prospect. I can't even keep track of what you're doing these days, David.
Well, and NIU. Yeah, because you have 18 radio shows, so you shouldn't be one to talk.
Well, you know, that's part of the job description, the talking.
It is part of the job. This is the new economy where we're defined by the number of jobs we have to scrounge up to make a living.
I think our former president said that was uniquely American. If I recall correctly. All right, so you've got a couple of pieces, and I want to go through them. To a certain extent, they're related, at least a couple of them. You have been no one has been on been reporting on the banks and relative to their malfeasance in the context of the mortgage crisis like you have been over the past couple of years. And you have a piece, I believe it's in the American Prospect, that deals with how the courts are now starting to address some of this stuff in terms of class action. It is, people know that I do a program called Ring of Fire on the weekends with Mike Papantonio, one of the biggest plaintiff attorneys in the country, and I am very sensitive to issues about class action and torts, because I think it provides an incredibly important function in our society. But tell us this story about Bank of America. Why were they facing a class action suit?
Yeah, so months ago I reported on this class action lawsuit that a group of homeowners who believe themselves eligible for loan modifications under the government's HAMP program, and that was President Obama's program, the Home Affordable Modification Program, that gave incentive payments to mortgage servicers to modify loans for borrowers who were in trouble. And it really didn't work well as a program, but let me just
tease out.
Yeah.
So the incentive payments were essentially you can modify their loans and you can do so without losing much money because we're going to make up we're going to supplement your income.
Well,
essentially,
the government was paying, I believe, $4,500 per loan directly to the servicers to try to encourage them to modify these loans. Now, it actually made financial sense for the servicer to modify the loans anyway, because the difference between continuing to collect modified payments from a homeowner versus having to sell the home in a foreclosure sale, you make more money over time just modifying the payments and keeping the borrower in the home. Problem was is that the incentives for mortgage servicers are completely different than the incentives for the underlying owners of the loan. While an owner of the loan would benefit in the way I just said, modifying the loan and keeping the borrower in the home rather than a foreclosure sale, for a servicer, because of various fees that are accorded to them when someone is in foreclosure, because of the fact that in a foreclosure sale, a servicer gets paid out first, they actually financially benefit from foreclosing on a borrower over giving them a modification.
Who pays them the fees? I mean, where does when the servicer and just to be clear for people, also just, you know, and we've talked about this many times, but just delineate for us the difference between a servicer and someone who owns the loan.
Sure. So most loans these days, home loans, are originated by a mortgage broker, an originator, and then sold into a secondary market where the loan is sold, packaged into a security, and then you know, resold out all over the country, all over the world, to various investors. And that can be anything from a pension fund to an institutional investor to a union fund or you know, anyone who purchases securities or bonds could be an investor and thereby an owner of a home loan in a mortgage-backed security. The servicer is hired by the company that packages up these loans, known as a trustee bank. The trustee bank, which does the sale, it buys the thousands of loans, makes the security, and then sells out the security to investors. They then hire a servicer, which is basically an accounts payable and receivable department. They take your money from your monthly payment, and they distribute it to the investors. So they're a go-between, basically. The problem is that their financial incentives are so screwed up that they do not act in the best interest of the underlying investors, the owners, the true owners of the loan.
Well, I mean, I guess it's...
And that's what we saw.
I guess it's sweet insofar as that they're willing to screw both ends of, you know, both.
Yes, they are equal opportunity offenders, absolutely.
And so who pays?
And in this Bank of America case, yeah, who pays the fees? The homeowners pay the fees.
Okay.
They pay, if they finally get a modification, it usually gets capitalized. It gets put into the unpaid principal balance. In other cases, it gets folded into the foreclosure sale. A homeowner is responsible for all legal fees, any kinds of fees associated with a foreclosure. The homeowner is responsible. So if you're a homeowner and you get into trouble, you're in foreclosure and you want to get out of it, you have to pay up all these fees in addition to getting current on your payments.
Okay.
And all of that fee profit goes directly to the servicers, does not go to the investors. So, obviously, a servicer wants to put you in foreclosure because they're going to make a lot of money in fees afterwards, and they don't get hurt in a foreclosure sale because, as I just said, they are first in line. When a foreclosure sale is completed, the servicer, which is paid as basically they're paid a small percentage of the unpaid principal balance. That's how a servicer gets paid to do this process of taking monthly payments and sending them to the investors, that gets paid out first. So they never lose money on a foreclosure, and they stand to gain a lot of money in fees in a foreclosure. So obviously, they're going to want to foreclose.
Didn't the Obama administration understand this dynamic? I mean, you know, there was billions of dollars that were available for HAMP. They seem to have pick the wrong person to subsidize.
Exactly. And it was a woefully small subsidy compared to the money that could be made in foreclosure. I mean, that's the real problem, is that the incentive payments were not enough to reverse the incentives. And in fact, there are also cases of servicers that accept the incentive payments and then still put the person into foreclosure, so they make money all around. which is delightful. So this case, let's get to this specific case of Bank of America. We had a situation which was kind of an open and shut case. You had multiple ex-employees of Bank of America all over the country testify in this case that they were instructed to lie to homeowners, they were instructed to misplace homeowners' financial documents, and they were instructed to take eligible homeowners who should have been in line for a loan modification and push them into foreclosure. In fact, they were given Target and Best Buy gift cards from management at the loan modification departments for the more people, you know, there were bonuses to push people into foreclosure. So you had this evidence come out. It didn't come out as part of this vaunted set of investigations that the Obama administration was supposed to be undertaking through the Justice Department or what have you. It came out because a group of homeowners who said they were eligible for a loan modification, didn't get one, were in fact put in foreclosure, banded together or tried to, and got a law firm willing to take the case. And the law firm then has to certify that they have the evidence and have the ability to create class action lawsuits full of homeowners against Bank of America for these practices. And in so doing, they found these ex-employees who were willing to testify that they that these practices occurred and that it was a pattern in practice and that that should make it such a case that it was eligible for class action certification.
I mean, this is just jaw-dropping. I mean, the first, I mean, before we get further about the disposition of that case, what's also stunning is we hear this, and we've talked about this many times, but it's still just how are the people who gave them bonuses for forcing these people into foreclosure, how are they not in jail? How are they not facing trial?
Exactly.
How is this not criminal?
Exactly. And it is, and they should have been. And not only did we get testimony from these ex-employees, they testified specific names of officers and directors who were authorizing this conduct, number one. And number two, they said it was all done through email. So there is a documentary record of these demands that were put on loan level, you know, line level customer service representatives at the loan modification departments at Bank of America. And by the way, these people were all over the country. It wasn't just a rogue unit of the loan modification department. It was all over the country. So we have a documentary record. We have names that were named. And yet, this comes out in an attempted class action lawsuit, and not as part of an investigation where those records, those documentary records, could be subpoenaed, where all of this information could go into law enforcement, where they could have a massive investigation and then get relief. Instead, what we had is kind of a private attorney general, right? That a law firm that is bringing this to the public. As a deliberate pattern to swindle homeowners and push them into foreclosure, and they did it through this attempt at a class action certification, and that's where it runs into this effort by corporate America to sort of close the courthouse door to individuals trying to sue them.
And in this case, the fact that they were denied certification as a class for the purposes of this suit is perhaps the perfect metaphor for all that is problematic about so-called tort reform, and shows exactly why class action suits are so crucial to providing some type of secondary regulatory function in society. So why were these homeowners denied a class action status, which is the only way they could afford to get an attorney, because an attorney's not going to do all of this work, all of this subpoena, all this discovery, all of this interviewing for the sake of one homeowner, because it's just not enough money. Why were they denied?
Well, there's a very stringent process that you have to go through to acquire class action certification these days, and it comes through a number of different Supreme Court rulings The most famous and dramatic being Walmart versus Dukes in 2011, when 1.5 million women who were believed they were discriminated against by Walmart in the pay practices and promotion practices attempted to put together a class action lawsuit on that. And the Supreme Court not only denied that class action, but incorporated a whole number of new steps that people, litigants attempting to get class action status had to go through, putting a lot of the discovery up front and a lot of the things that had to happen that to prove that this was not just a practice that was common, a common question among all the people in the class action, but that was the predominant practice, that it was the main thing that bound together all of these various actors into one unit, and it was the main thing that was happening to them. So they did that. This law firm did that in this Bank of America case, but basically they were told by the court that while this was a Kafkaesque process and that these homeowners' claims may well be meritorious, that's in the lawsuit, in the order by the federal judge here. She said, your claims may be meritorious, but there are different questions in each person's claims, and so that we cannot put these together into one specific class. And basically what this says is that Bank of America had such a complex, convoluted process where you had to jump through so many hoops and certify so many things in order to get a loan modification, that the very nature of that convoluted process means that each situation of someone trying to get a loan modification is different. And because it's somewhat different, that even though it could be a symptomatic situation where homeowners are being pushed into foreclosure deliberately, having their documents lost deliberately, having being lied to deliberately, because the individual cases are somewhat different and turn on somewhat different things, then you can't be a class.
So let me see. I'm going to restate this just to make sure that this is absolutely clear. Bank of America has a company-wide policy as a servicer to get as many people into foreclosure as possible by hook or crook. But because each individual who is subject to that policy, one person was done by hook, the other person was done by crook.
Right.
That is why they can't be considered a class action. Even though they were all subject to the same nefarious policy, the tactics used by each individual servicer working, you know, in one place, the guy in St. Louis used a different technique than the guy in Atlanta, and so therefore it's not a class action.
That's generally correct. I mean, the case specifically turned on the fact that for some people they had to make three payments at a trial payments. For some people they had to certify that they went through credit counseling. For some people it was the steps that had to be taken initially to get the loan modification that created this difference, this variety in the cases. And there were these individual questions that had to be answered. Did this person go through this series of steps? And did they go through this series of steps? And that made each person different. It wasn't the method by which the servicer denied the modification necessarily, as the very nature of the process itself, which is even more unbelievable, because it assumes that Bank of America set up a loan modification process that is impossible to be adjudicated through a class action, because there are so many steps to it. I mean, that's essentially what they're saying. In one case, you know, Bank of America basically claimed that some of the people in the class action lawsuit did not follow these prescribed steps. In one case, they said, well, this person was supposed to go through credit counseling and she never did. And that person replied that she did try to go through credit counseling, but the phone number for the in-house credit counseling department that Bank of America gave her was incorrect and impossible to get through to. So basically you have Bank of America arguing that we Our steps are so convoluted that every situation is different, and so you can't file a class action lawsuit against us. And that was succeeded.
It is stunning. And you make mention of this in the piece, but this is indicative of a larger trend that we've talked about on this program of the implications of things like tort reform, the implications of class action reform. Basically, yeah. We're seeing courts effectively. We have seen the shutdown of regulators in holding the line here, and now what we're seeing is any other potential redress by citizens to deal with right. what the court concedes looks, at least on its face, as a claim that is legitimate. There's just no way to do it for practical purposes. There's no way to do it.
Yeah, it's a big problem, and it's indicative of how corporate interests have really taken over as far as the judicial system is concerned. There was a study that was put out by, I believe, Richard Posner, a judge in a circuit court, that looked at the last 50 years and looked at the justices of the Supreme Court with the most pro-corporate rulings, where they found in favor of the corporation over the individual. Over the last 50 years, and of the top 10, five of those are the five conservative justices now sitting on the Supreme Court.
Right.
And number one and number two were Justices Alito and Roberts. And so it's a rigged game. If you're an individual trying to sue a corporation and the case gets passed up all the way to the Supreme Court, you're going to probably get a ruling that not only diminishes your claim, but makes it harder for anybody else behind you to make a similar kind of claim in the future. And as I say in the piece, you know, this is along a continuum of these various rulings that make it harder and harder to certify class action status and harder for individuals to go through that route so that they then have to, if they have a complaint, go through an individual litigation process, and law firms simply aren't going to take that for the reasons that you said before. It's an enormous expense for not very much reward, even though it's important to the individual. It might be a lot of money to the individual. For a law firm to go through all of the expense of presenting a case, it's just not cost effective for them.
It's just not practical in any way, and that's the key that people should take away from this case, is that this is not just about a one-off adjudication in favor of a corporation. What it is basically saying that private citizens don't have a means of redress. We're going to shut the courtroom doors, never mind just settle this case in one way. All right, let's speaking of closing the doors, you have another piece in Alternet that is in some ways just sort of an extension of what these people tried to remedy in this class action case. It's right. still going on. Just tell us about this case.
Right. So, I mean, what we did see by the federal government is that they took the big five mortgage servicers, and Bank of America was one of them. Most of them were aligned with big banks, Bank of America, Citi, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, Ally Bank. And they did do this settlement. It was certainly a somewhat toothless settlement, but it was a settlement. With the five servicers over a lot of acts of intentional fraud and not just things that came up in this case that I just mentioned, but, filing millions of false documents with courts, for example. So, in that settlement, there were supposed to be a number of standards that servicers were supposed to meet. When you called them, you were supposed to have a single point of contact, so you didn't have to contact. So you didn't have to explain your situation over and over to brand new people who had no idea what you were talking about. You were supposed to not be dual-tracked, which is put into foreclosure while you're seeking a loan modification. That was supposed to be ruled illegal. And a number of other standards, pro-consumer standards, to protect the homeowner. Well, the way that Bank of America and these other banks have gotten around that is they've simply sold their servicing rights off. And they've sold them off because it's now there's too many labor costs involved with servicing these mortgages if you actually have to do your job and actually, you know, help someone with a loan modification, which is sort of a high-touch customer response, rather than just pushing them in foreclosure. So they sold them off, and the companies that are buying these servicing rights are usually not banks. They are specialty firms. They're companies with names like Ocwen and Walter Investment Management and NationStar. And I focus on NationStar in this alternate piece. And they have some of the worst records from a customer service standpoint of practically any customer-facing company I've ever seen. We didn't think it could get worse than what Bank of America was doing. But the example I use in the NationStar case is that there was a family out here in Altadena, California, and they got a knock at their door. They had never missed a payment on their loan. They were current on their loan for 12 years, as far as they knew. They got a knock at their door, and they were told, your house has been sold, and you have 2 weeks to get out, and you owe us rent for the 2 weeks, by the way, that you're still here. You have 2 weeks and you got to pack your things and get out of here. Turned out their servicing rights were sold to NationStar. They had done a loan modification the year before. They actually got it secured. But NationStar simply did not recognize the loan modification that they got and were charging them their full original mortgage payment. And when they sent a payment in that was not the full payment, they just put them into foreclosure and sold their house out from under them. A local affiliate of ABC got involved, and NationStar rescinded this, but how many people have they not done that to? So you have these non-bank servicers that aren't bound by the agreements of these settlements, so they do not recognize prior agreements made with homeowners. And they are generally corrupt and horrible customer service representatives anyway. So this is where the mortgage servicing business is going, into the hands of these non-bank servicers. If you thought it couldn't get worse, it can.
Do we know? Do we know how many families there are like the Sinclairs? I mean, you mentioned that ABC Television got involved in this. It created some pressure, or the local affiliate. But I mean, do we have a sense? I mean, how ongoing is this? In other words, I mean,
we don't have a sense. I mean, we can't have a sense. I mean, there's no way of knowing how many people this could happen to. What we know is that if it can happen to the Sinclairs, it can happen to anyone. And we know that there were thousands of people in the last settlement that never missed a payment and yet were kicked out of their house. And the fact that it can continue to happen after you did a allegedly punitive settlement with these companies, that they can pass the servicing rights off to these other companies who are doing the same things, is incredibly troubling.
I know how much the Attorney General's office in New York loves to hear from you. Did you get a sense? I mean, Schneiderman sat on this on the last, financial fraud committee. Do you have a sense of like what their response to this is?
Well, there hasn't been much. I mean, what we do know is that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, now, for the first time ever, has the ability to examine non-bank servicing companies, and they have done so. And what they have found, there was a report that came out this summer, and what they have found is that these companies not only are engaging in some of this really terrible behavior, but they don't even have compliance standards because they never had to comply with anything before. They never had examiners inside their businesses. And so they just don't even have written procedures for how to comply with various laws, you know, various consumer laws, protection laws, that are part of their business. So you're really just starting right back at square one. CFPB, inside these companies now, and they are working to try to fix some of these problems, but they would have to devote every single resource they have 24/7 to catch everything, in my view.
So, in other words, I mean, is what happened in this case, did Nation Star break any laws? I mean, presumably, right? The modification is a contract that the family made with somebody else.
Their previous services, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, does Nation Star, I guess
they're just not honoring it. And yes, that I believe that violates various consumer protection laws, and including the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, or RESPA. There have been cases where CFPB says that they've gotten in there and they have, had remediation for families who've been harmed. But I don't see any penalties beyond that have come out, at least yet, out of CFPB, and certainly not out of any of the other various law enforcement agencies in state or federal government.
And so Nation Star is probably just thinking, like, well, we in certain instances, we got to watch out, but we just got to continue to prey on those who are financially illiterate or without the resources to fight this, right. And that's what we've been doing since day one anyway.
If we get caught, we give everything back, and it's the cost of doing business. But how many are they not getting caught on is the question. And so it seems to be a really unless CFPB figures out a way that they can really crack down on this, and it would require a serious resource commitment, we're moving towards a situation where even worse actors are moving into the lead in the mortgage servicing business, which has already shown itself to be almost hopelessly corrupt and broken.
Happy
Monday. Happy Tuesday.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, I don't even know how to really respond to it. I mean, it's just so depressing and so despicable. And we've basically just created this sort of, like, as cesspool-y as it was before, it's now really even less,
right.
There's less capacity to go in and clean up the muck in some ways, because it's just been sort of,
they've emptied out the waste of the cesspool and put it into a dirtier cesspool. and that is, to use your metaphor, to borrow your metaphor, what's going on in the mortgage servicing business.
The best hope for any type of change in this situation is that a company like Nation Star ends up foreclosing on some senator's house, I guess, right? I mean, that's the...
It's funny you mention that, because one thing, I did a story a while ago on Nation Star, and one reason why this floated up to the top of Bank of America is that a personal friend of Brian Moynihan, who's the CEO of Bank of America, had his servicing rights, which were with Bank of America, transfers to Nation Star. And he writes Brian Moynihan an email saying, what I'm reading is this is the worst company on earth. Why would you sell your servicing rights to this company? And Brian Moynihan, who's a figurehead, and, CEO, he didn't really know anything about it, and he starts questioning why they're doing this to the people responsible, the executives responsible at B of A, and there's a series of cover-your-ass emails that go back and forth. But it was because a personal friend of Brian Moynihan had his servicing rights transferred over to Nation Star. So what you said in jest is actually not far from the truth of what it would actually take to get some trackdowns.
All right. All right. Well, David, I just want to touch. We just have a minute here or two left here. I want to touch and just go to something that is, in some respects, equally as disturbing, but different at least. I mean, this one's a little bit more out in the open. I know you sat down for a great two-part interview with Congressman Alan Grayson, and we will link to that. People should really read this.
Right.
But over the course of your conversations with him, mapping out where he thinks we are going in terms of a government shutdown, One of the things that appears to be clear is that in some ways, well, you write it. The title of your piece is "The Budget Battle the GOP Has Already Won." What do you mean by that?
Well, you mentioned Grayson, and I asked him about the shutdown and his concerns, and he really was unconcerned. He believed that the House would pass something, and indeed they did on Friday. It didn't matter what they passed. The Senate would strip out anything, referring to Obamacare about it, and send it back to the House. And sometime at midnight on September 30th, something would pass, mostly with the support of House Democrats. Now, that sounds good. But the thing that Grayson added is that it's extremely likely that this short-term continuing resolution to fund the government would enforce these sequestration limits into 2014. And the sequestration is something that nobody really wanted to come into play. It was supposed to be a forcing event to create the conditions because it was such a big, bad, stupid, across-the-board set of budget cuts that it would force somehow Democrats and Republicans to get together and create a saner, more reasonable budget deal. It never did that, and in February of this year, it did get put into practice. And what Grayson is saying is that Democrats have basically resigned themselves to the fact that the least worst alternative here is to continue the sequester. The problem is that the sequester has been really terrible policy, and the Congressional Budget Office has put out a number of reports showing that if you would just cancel sequestration, you could create almost 1 million jobs in 2014 just by getting rid of it and allowing the federal government's budget to increase by I believe it's $90 billion per year for another 9 years or something like that. So just by doing that, you can create 1 million jobs. So the easiest job creation policy that you'll ever come up against. And yet, because we still have this mindset of the deficit prioritized over almost everything, because Republicans have been so extreme in their demands, the fallback, reasonable, wise middle course is to continue to enforce this really stupid, wrongheaded sequestration policy.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And we're stuck with this now. It's now the new baseline. And people should understand that next year, there was a lot of talk about how these cuts were not felt by anybody, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the most sort of public and I guess rich people affecting cuts were dealt with by Congress.
Right.
Maybe that'll happen again next year. But we're looking at, in terms of the fiscal year, almost twice as many cuts as we sustained this year. And of course, those people dealing with the cuts are the poor and anything that involves sort of long-term investment, like research or something.
Right. Long-term investment. We're seeing almost a revolution in cutbacks in science and technology and health, public health, and things like that. That kind of investment, which always pays off in the future, is really being damaged.
Wasn't there at one point talk of when the bill gets back to the Senate, when the budget gets back to the Senate, that they would not only strip the defund Obamacare part, but they would also add in reversal of some sequester cuts and send that back to the House? That plan seems to have been jettisoned now. And I think Noam Schreiber in the New Republic sort of described that as an Obama cave. In other words, saying to the Democrats, the administration says to the Democrats in the House, just pass this clean continuing resolution instead of forcing the Republicans to swallow rollbacks on the sequester. Is your reporting consistent with that?
Anytime you hear clean continuing resolution, that means with the sequester, sequestration completely intact. Considering, just look at the public relations of the White House over the last few weeks. They're bragging about the fact that the deficit is going to be cut in half, from the point at which the president took office. you can bet that next week when the fiscal year ends and we see what the final number is on the budget deficit in the previous fiscal year, 2013, that administration officials will come out and they will brag that they got the deficit down. And then at the same time, they say that unemployment hasn't been, you know, moving along as quickly as we hoped. But those two things are related. I mean, when you cut the budget deficit in the midst of a recovery, you have this slump in public sector jobs and as well in consumer spending and in just fiscal policy. And that's going to have an impact on jobs in the economy. There's a great piece actually by Kevin Drum in this. It's the cover story of Mother Jones this week, this month, and it talks about how we've cut about $4 trillion since 2010 out of the budget, and that can't help but have a very negative effect on job creation right at a time after we got out of this horrible jobs crisis, the worst since the Great Depression. So it was the wrong thing to do then, and enforcing the sequester limits into 2014 is the wrong thing to do now.
And the bottom line is just that the administration feels that it's politically more sustainable to have this type of to have this type of employment situation than it would be to face the slings and arrows of the establishment saying you're not cutting the deficit enough.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
Oh, well, David, always a pleasure, always uplifting to talk to you.
Rainbows and sunshine.
All right. David Dayen, but seriously, always really just incredibly informative. Really appreciate your work, and thank you so much for taking the time.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
There he is, rainbows and sunshine, ladies and gentlemen, rainbows and sunshine. And we have so much more rainbows and sunshine for you in the better half of the program. We'll be talking about the rent seeking. I just saw a piece that pointed out the amazing statistics. This is prior to the crash, but probably we'll get back to the norm of just what percent of people from Princeton go into financial services. People who graduate Princeton. We'll also talk more about the potential for cuts to Social Security in the debt ceiling fight. Yes, I know. Zombie cuts. And we're contemplating here in the office adopting the new Newsweek rules for dress code and the way that we act around each other.
So you guys would really need to adjust your behavior and dress a lot.
I don't. I think actually Matt would be in trouble with the dress code. All right, we got to take a break. What's that?
You the behavior.
Right. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more. Your calls, 646-257-3920. Your IMs at Majority FM or via your app. You don't even need to know the address. Automatic. Remember, app is available for download at majorityapp.com. See you on the flip side.